Hi, this is Joe Van Wee, your host of All Better. I had a few announcements. If you're interested in subscriber content, which we're about to launch, this would be STEP workshops, cognitive behavioral therapy tools, and mindfulness practices that are approachable and can be very useful in reducing anxiety, rumination, and depression. Please send us a message on Facebook, Instagram, or LinkedIn. And if you like the episodes that you've been hearing very much, please stop by Apple Podcasts and give us a 5-star rating and a small review. This helps us stay relevant in the field of content and helping people and their families with substance use disorder. Thank you. Hello, and thanks again for listening to another episode of All Better. I'm your host, Joe Van Wee. If you like what you hear, please stop by Apple Podcasts and give us a review. It takes about a minute. Helps us be more relevant in mental health services, searches for a podcast or substance use disorder. Today's guest is my friend, Jonathan Blake. Jonathan is currently a licensed social worker in Pennsylvania. Jonathan obtained both bachelor's and master's degrees in social work from Marywood University, graduating with his MSW in 2014, Jonathan has worked in the substance use field as a primary counselor in both inpatient and outpatient settings. And he currently works as a medical social worker with the main focus on behavioral health. Jonathan stops by today to talk about recovery, incarceration, and a topic that is getting much attention locally, nationwide, solitary confinement. Let's meet Jonathan and start the discussion. Breaking the wall. Okay. So my friend John Blake, who is All Better's first guest, your second guest, John's a licensed social worker, and tell us a little bit about a petition that was drumming around this summer. But we're going to talk about incarceration, the dignity of recovery that could be found in incarceration, and solitary confinement, which is defined as torture. And specifically, I think that's where we could start. And John, if you don't mind, I'm going to define it. Solitary confinement. Of prisoners goes by a number of names: isolation, SHU, special housing units, administrative segregation, supermax prisons, the whole MCU, that's management control units, CMU, communications management units, STGMU, security threat group management units, voluntary or involuntary protective custody, special needs units, or permanent lockdown. Although solitary confinement conditions vary from state to state and among correctional facilities, systematic policies and conditions include this when we're talking about solitary confinement today. Confinement behind a solid steel door for 22 to 24 hours a day. Severely limited contact with other human beings. Infrequent phone calls and rare non-contact family visits. Extremely limited access to rehabilitative or educational programming. Grossly inadequate medical and mental health treatment. Restricted reading material and personal property. Physical torture, such as hog tying, restraint chairs, forced cell extraction. This one's freakish to just fucking read. It looks like Soviet. No touch torture, such as sensory deprivation, permanent bright lighting, extreme temperatures, and forced insomnia. Chemical torture, such as stun guns and stun grenades. And sexual intimidation and other forms of brutality and humiliation. So when we're talking about solitary confinement, I wanted to take the time to read that because it is a pretty broad thing, and it's given unique names for its use. Some of them sounded utilitarian. Some of them sounded even like they were mental health or protective. But every one of these definitions, according to every dignified entity and organization from Geneva to human rights organizations define this as torture. John, do we have this at our county jail locally and state? Is solitary confinement kind of a normal practice?
As far as my experience and understanding is, yeah, there's segregation units in county jails, state prisons, federal prisons, commonly used. Segregation's used on admission into a jail or intake into a jail, medical quarantine to make sure that people are safe to be part of the population of the prison prior to entering it. But yeah, as far as I know.
So when you arrive, let's make some distinctions. County prison. How would you describe the difference between county prison and state prison?
As far as the arrival?
Yeah.
I would say it is. So, I mean, county, when you go into a county jail, you're going in, you know, the first step would be, you know, going into a medical block or a segregation unit, as it would be called, for anywhere from, you know, I guess it could range from 1 to X amount of days, 7 days. I think 3 to 4 days would be the normal experience for most people. A TB test is typically done, physical, that kind of stuff, to, I guess, to make sure that there's no, you know, communicable diseases or viruses or you're not sick or something. So it sounds reasonable. Right.
Yeah.
But so for that unit, if once you go in there, you're in a cell 24 hours a day. So, I mean, once you go into the county jail, I mean, you are locked down. I mean, there's no yard, there's no rec, there's no basketball. There may be an hour out that lacks any kind of recreation, maybe an opportunity to use a phone, but they're probably difficult to get to, limited time, not real opportunities to do that. So so when you go into a county jail, I mean, you are stripped away from everything, you know, and you don't have, obviously you wouldn't have the perks that come with being in jail after a period of time. So you would have nothing. Going into a state prison would look a little different because for most people, they've been incarcerated for X amount of time while they've been in trial and now they're transferring to a prison. And for most people, it's, you know, for lack of a better concept, it's a joyous kind of situation. Most people are looking forward to go to a state prison because county jails are typically, there's less services, less things going on for people and less opportunities.
Wow. I've never considered that. I mean, you just want to get, especially if you're doing what, over 3 years, 5 years, you want to
get to your home. Yeah.
Yeah. So there is a circumstance that seems, you know, utilitarian. You're going to be isolated when you're on arrival, medical reasons, TB, waiting for tests. You have no, you know, I don't know what the amenities of jail, the phone calls, the canteen or the commissary. So that's not, even though you're alone, you're alienated from the rest of the prison, you're isolated for those reasons. Would you consider that solitary confinement?
So, I think also you'd be in a cell with another person. So, you wouldn't be completely isolated. But if we go back to that definition that was read, I mean, it severely limited human contact. So even if you're in there with one person,
that could be really deranged.
Right. Or they could, you know, be nonverbal or, you know, like any number of things could be going on with them. So there is some, there is a purpose behind it and it seems reasonable. And then on the other side that I think that most people think of when solitary is used is for, to keep other people safe within the prison or to keep a person safe in a prison. And I think when it's described that way or presented that way, then it's people like, of course, there has to be tools at the disposal of the institution to keep people safe in the institution.
Well, I have a website up. It's AFSC.org. It's a resource for a lobby to get rid of this as a torture. And one of the tabs here is, why are people placed in solitary confinement? The other one, from not just the processing of getting into jail. Now we're kind of talking about it being an extra punitive measure, be it for a justification of protecting the other population, or it's a punishment. They're saying prisoners can be placed in isolation for many reasons, from serious infractions, such as fighting with another inmate, to minor ones, like talking back to a guard or getting caught with a pack of cigarettes, Other times, prisoners are thrown into solitary confinement for not breaking any rules at all. Prisons have used solitary confinement as a tool to manage gangs, isolating people for simply talking to a suspected gang member. Prisons have also used solitary confinement as retribution for political activism. So I just, I mean, this is how long has this movement that we're, maybe we should describe it. You were part of an effort this summer to get a petition signed. Many social workers and people in the area that had this idea that solitary confinement's torture. What was that? What was that call here locally in Lackawanna County?
So it was really, yeah, I just jumped on board of a group that was really, that was already doing it. They were deep into it. They had been doing it for a while. NEPA stands up, Northeastern PA stands up, which is part of a large organization, PA stands up, which has been doing this in other counties. I believe they were successful in Allegheny County, in getting it as a ballot measure so people could vote on, you know, changing how solitary is used or what the practice of solitary confinement is in their local jail. So they were effective there. And then the same organization or same goal in Lackawanna County and Lehigh County. And yeah, the number of the threshold for signatures was around 9,000. They reached that. They exceeded that. And they were submitted to the Board of Electors.
And so it's caught up right now. There was an article not too long ago. It's caught up. If Home Rule Charter needs to acknowledge this for it to be on a ballot, county decision, kind of putting that on its own place and still talking about the legal definition of torture and this being used in a civil society. Have you experienced, treating or giving therapy or working as a social worker with people who had, long-term effects from being in solitary confinement?
I worked with people who had effects of long-term incarceration, and the majority of people who've been incarcerated, especially for a long time, have spent some time in isolation or segregated just because, you know, when we go back to the rationale for using this or for this practice, and people think of, you know, keeping people safe or violating the rules within a prison. And then you read all the reasons that it's actually used for. And that's what you see most of the time, or in my experience, what I saw most of the time as a punitive measure and retribution measure, you know, threatening to take people to the hole, minor infractions, talking back to a guard, just really anything. Because again, that is, when you're in a jail and your freedom's taken away and you start to then, you know, build a life in a prison and, you know, you have some freedoms, like maybe you have a TV in your cell, you have a guitar in your cell. You're attending some little business class that the prison puts on. It's not a college class, but a business class. So you're doing some of these things, and then going to the hole or in segregation removes all of that from you. So all of these things that you've built up, or you've built, are taken away, you know, just because of somebody's having, you know, just because they decide and that's how they want to do it. And similarly, you know, my experience in seeing the way, the criminal justice population or the incarcerated population has been treated, it's similarly with probation and parole, minor infractions and you know, people being sent back to jail on violations and keep going back and going back, not breaking another crime, not committing a new offense, not doing something to harm society, but breaking a rule, like a rule that's been put in place by probation and parole. And then again, being removed from society, pulled out and put in the hole of society, which would be prison. And then again, once you're in prison, then, you know,
So the crime falls under this broad description of what a violation could be.
Yeah. It would be like,
but it's not a direct crime. It's, yeah, you like broke the rule.
Maybe you got fired from your job and you didn't get a job and you know, the amount of time that the probation officer wanted you to, maybe you changed addresses and you didn't let them know. I mean, whatever the rules are for the probation or the parole, and you're not following them. But yeah, certainly not crimes or illegal activities.
All right, going back to how long have you ever heard of maybe firsthand or read about, what's the longest someone could be in a solitary confinement?
I mean, decades? Yeah.
Oh my God. I mean,
if we think about death row and what death row is and people who are waiting execution, what those units look like, secure housing units in state prisons. I mean, there's long-term people in there. Yeah. There's folks that don't, you know, they're not in the hole for 30 days and then coming back to the block or coming back to the unit and, you know, we'll be playing ball with them again soon. Like, no, they're just on J block. Like, that's where they are now.
And did this idea of confining one person, do you think it started as a measure to first it's to protect the public, then within the jail to protect the population of the jail? Is there merit? And before we started to redefine what torture is for.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hello, my name is Joe Van Wee. I'm the host of All Better, but I'm also the CEO of Fellowship House. And at Fellowship House, we believe long-term recovery requires a personality change as well as a clinical intervention. These ideas can take several months to achieve. Our philosophy is to provide a safe, therapeutic, and exceedingly active environment for patients to achieve these personality changes and find joy in the fellowship of recovery, which will allow for long-term sobriety. We believe that recovery extends beyond treatment and peer-to-peer communities into real life. At Fellowship House, we provide a design for living that focuses on education and service. We have strong relationships with the 12 universities and vocational schools in the area and assure that our fellows pursue their personal goals while entering sobriety. We also stress independence and responsibility, making sure each individual is financially solid and self, and helping to make their community a better place. As a treatment center, Fellowship House offers both residential and outpatient treatment services to individuals and families affected by addiction and alcoholism. We're a DDAP licensed provider of general outpatient, intensive outpatient, and partial hospitalization programming, as well as a level of care assessments. If you want to find out more information about Fellowship House, please visit fellowshiphouses.com.
I don't know. I guess part of me thinks that people are punitive and want revenge and want retribution and want people to suffer. And people who, you know, I would have to think of who would want to be in the position, like in the roles that then you're putting somebody in the hole, like what motivates somebody to be there. Because again, the power and the control that comes with it, that's inherent with it, that we've built into it, you know, it's just,
Now, is there many Western nations in Europe that do not allow for solitary confinement? It's defined as torture.
Yeah.
So just to read off a couple, that's all right. My arm fell off. Some long-term effects that a person can experience from any period of solitary confinement within the jail: visual and auditory hallucinations, hypersensitivity to noise and touch, insomnia, paranoia, uncontrollable feelings of rage and fear, distortions of time and perception, increased risk of suicide, and post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, which is just constantly reliving a trauma. Now, I could think someone could callously say, well, this is deviance. These people had some agency and chose a life of crime. And what this is the offering we all agreed to, is to torture them if they broke.
Yeah, break the law.
And, you know, you could go from the extremes of, you know, it's very possible a scenario, a guy's in there for addiction, crimes of addiction, DUIs, you know, to risk, multiple offender, goes to jail, breaks the rules in jail, is just not getting through this process easily or gets himself in trouble. So essentially a scenario could arise where he goes to solitary confinement and, you know, his real issue is a mental health disorder or substance use disorder. What does this do to a person? And why I'm thinking of it is I'm thinking of Rat Park, was it Johann Hari, shares it, and Brett Alexander, his, uncle, he was the, did this Rat Park experiment for drug addicted rats, and all of them were addicted when they were isolated. They're like, well, this is kind of, there's no control here or other offering. When they gave them a community and a nice park, a lot of them broke the addiction, these rats. Now, we're more complex than rats, but just in the context of that, you have a mental health crisis. Your crimes are being committed not out of like a psychopathy or a pathology to harm others. You have had a life of trauma. Your crimes of that, of your socioeconomic situation and mental health. Now, as a measure to deal with you, we're going to put you in a room and the lights don't fucking go off. You can't sleep. No one cares about your medical situation, your mental health. What the fuck, man?
Yeah.
Like what is the solution to this? Like, why is it jarring for us to start to reconsider this?
It's strange to me because the people suffering from severe mental illness, mainly severe mental illness, people with, you know, more mild or maybe are able to navigate and negotiate things differently. But people with severe mental illness are already like the voiceless public. And then so we further alienate and take away their voice in a prison. Because again, yeah, like you said, like nobody cares about your medical, your mental health. I mean, they certainly... You hope that they're going to do everything they can to keep people alive and, you know, and treat people, at least the bare minimum of care. But yeah, I mean, you're further alienating and marginalizing an already marginalized population. And then the way you're treating it and the way you're handling it exacerbates mental health symptoms, as we just heard. And so then in a prison or in an institution like that, how do you think when mental health symptoms manifest, how do you think they're responded to?
Yeah. And when in history did punishment work, like to outlaw murder, say even the worst crimes, but so not these petty crimes of just, you emerge in a situation, you don't choose like the continent you're born on. You don't choose the socioeconomics of your parents, your religion, your hair color, your eyes. And at some place, when do we tell that person they have sovereignty and they're autonomous? Hey, you're making your own decisions. They've had severe abuse, sexual, physical, verbal, domestic violence in their house. And now you're telling me that person has the same agency as other people, like the people who are not in jail are not. Why? What can we do? What would be the lobby to have sympathy, a sense of empathy beyond the crime? So there's just not these cheap discussions of, well, they're in jail.
Right.
Well, we have the largest prison population in the world. Like this, we're talking about millions of people and every one of them has solitary confinement. I mean, the majority. Would that be accurate?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And so this got on the ballot in Allegheny.
It got on the ballot in Allegheny. Yeah. They were successful in getting it as a ballot measure. Yeah.
So I wonder what is being laid out? Are they lifting models from Europe to say this could replace it? Like, does this cost the taxpayer reconstruction, like construction bill? Like what are we looking at that could be the pushback besides bureaucratic nonsense? Like you hear now, that's not a home rule. They're not even talking about torture.
Right.
Well, we can't.
Technically we can't.
Yeah. There's a charter in place and people are being tortured. Like, so do you believe it's torture or not? It really kind of comes down to.
Yeah. And that's it's another thing where I'm surprised that, I shouldn't be surprised, but I am that everybody isn't just like, yeah, why would we torture people who are incarcerated? Why would we want to do that to people? And, I mean, especially when you look at the lifetime incidence of incarceration and it's very common, you know, very common, especially for people of color. So it's something that we should all be able to empathize with because whether we experience it directly ourselves or we know people, family members, friends, loved ones could potentially have poor decision-making, can potentially be suffering from mental health issues and can potentially find themselves incarcerated. And again, when those same symptoms or those same issues present themselves in prison, ultimately it's going to be manifested as breaking the rules or doing something. And so again, you're going to be treated or the mechanisms that they have to think to stop that is what they're going to use. And that's going to be, you know, the hole or segregation or whatever they want to call it.
So it's kind of, we're still in this kind of muddy place, that's slowly changing. And I think, you know, Lackawanna County, in comparison, is progressive just when you take measurements of the drug court and just moving forward? What's the definition? I think people are still confused of punishment versus rehabilitation. A justice system that's kind of designed for the idea of revenge to be not chaos of a victim. So I just don't know, like, where's the first agency, like the first thing this group would want to do is define that this is torture, and the UN Convention Against Torture defines it. The state-sanctioned act by which a severe pain or suffering, whether it's physical or mental, intentionally inflicted on a person for information, punishment, intimidation, or any reason based on discrimination. In 2011, the UN had a special report on torture and warned solitary confinement can amount to torture or cruel, inhumane, degrading treatment and punishment when used as a punishment during pretrial detention, indefinitely for the prolonged period for persons with mental disabilities or juveniles. Juveniles are going in solitary confinement.
Yeah, it's horrifying. But just another thing that you mentioned, the pre-trial, right? The time in jail, that's people pre-trial. So pre-trial, what's the assumption?
You're guilty. Well, you should be.
Right, but you're actually innocent until proven guilty, right? Yeah. But then we're treated as...
Since you're innocent, let us allow you to stay here.
Right, and we'll leave the lights on for you all night.
Yes. Yeah, holy shit, man. Yeah, it's complex. I guess it's really, you know, do communities have a shared definition of compassion, what they're afraid of? Is this an individual case by case? But it can't be that. We're talking about architecture and structure of buildings that have been designed without any second hesitation for this to be the system. Mm-hmm. This is, you know, this definition has been out there since the 50s, 60s, and it's solitary confinement is increased exponentially since the 70s, every decade.
Yeah, just like our prison population.
Is there no voice against this? Is it because of it's hard for general public, people who don't have sympathy? What's the disconnect that 90, you know, most of these people are not violent criminals, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that, yeah. So my assumption would be that people just aren't aware that these things are going on. Right. And then when we come, we're like, oh, wow, like that shouldn't be there. And I think that's the case when you see the amount of signatures that they were able to get in Northeastern PA over a period of time and exceeding the amount of
13,000 around there.
Right. Yeah. And like, obviously people are into this idea, like maybe we should consider it. Maybe we should think about it. Maybe we could do a little bit better. Like, and I think that it may seem like an attack on the system as it is, but I guess that would only be is if that you feel that you're torturing people, that it would be an attack. Cause otherwise, I mean, if somebody said I was torturing people, I would just move on with my day and wouldn't think about it again. Cause I don't torture.
Well, I was in juvenile detention. I spent 18, 20 hours a day. If they were short staffed in the cell, light on, went off at night. Sometimes you'd have a roommate, sometimes you wouldn't. And, It was mind bending. You have to retreat somewhere deep. Forget. You kind of Buddhism washes over you, regardless of your knowledge or experience with it, or you will go mad. Yeah. You start bugging out. You start tripping, man. Like, was I always in this cell? Is this some kind of matrix pause in somewhere? I don't know, man. I kind of even, you know, the thought experiment. Okay. So we can't just say there was just for a thought experiment. We can't put this burden on the taxpayers to what redesign jails, fit more people in there. We're not change this whole system. Why don't we just insert pleasant music in there?
like music.
Like, yeah. Just elevator music and, you know, a PA system that gives, you know, guided meditations and, you know, I think you see the real horror in solitary confinement when you try to do the thought experiment of improving it
Yeah. Well, I think, yeah. I mean, like,
it sounds so psychotic.
Yeah. It's almost like we all know each person that is there is a dynamic individual with thoughts, feelings, attitudes, everything, fears, anxieties, everything. And maybe guided meditation, some people be like, oh, wow, this is cool. I'm into it. But not everybody, right? No, it would be torture. It would
be more torture,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah. So it's just kind of treating everybody the same.
When is it guided? When it's coerced? This isn't even like, yeah, you can't even use the right words to describe what you're doing. Coercive meditation. That's what it should be called. Yeah, you're meditate. Piping. Yeah. Open your ears. We got the lights on. Fuck. It sounds like you couldn't think of a worse nightmare, especially with, you know, I wouldn't describe myself as any kind of mood personality or disorder I could point to. Maybe it just lurks in there, but I have substance use disorder. I have generalized anxiety. If I committed a crime, I'd say it would be out of an active addiction. No withdrawal. I get sent there and make some mistake. I'm sent in solitary confinement. What a fucking nightmare. The nightmares that already go on in my head without being in jail. Now I'm confined into a room. I can't even imagine the size. Listening to guided meditation. No, but I mean, I can't believe juveniles. This is kind of obscene.
Yeah.
It's kind of gross, man.
Yeah. 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 I mean, whenever I think of the juvenile criminal justice system, like every part of it is horrifying because we treat it. There, folks in there are treated like adults. It's the same model. It's the same way. And they're children.
And you see clearly as a social worker, you're not seeing at that age, they didn't even get a chance. You're just seeing responses to trauma. The lens you just see?
Undeveloped brain. Yeah. Making poor decisions. We can't make diagnoses with children. I mean, you wouldn't want to. I mean, it's.
But you do see victims, like do you see it in the lens that they're a victim of like, just let's just peel it back, existence. Their existence does not meet the same variables, like it's causing these poor decision-making. They could be surrounded. And the probability of them making bad decisions, it's around them.
Yeah. Yeah. I might not, the word victim, maybe not, but yeah. Okay. But yeah, but they're, but people are pushed in a direction or in boxed in with the decisions that they can make.
I learn a lot when we're talking and we're friends and we shoot the breeze a lot. And I like to focus on stuff. Why not victim? Is that why would that be a bad word?
Just because I don't think everybody in that situation would see themselves as victims. Mm-hmm. I think the one thing that I forget sometimes too, is that people are very resilient and people don't view themselves as victims. And sometimes that can be more damaging, than, you know, it's done with like, oh, it's okay. You're a victim.
So you're saying the word can unpack an identity if
like used? Being helpless or okay. This, and maybe that's not the case. They're just been subjected to some really rotten things. Like in domestic violence, we refer to people as survivors and not victims because it's just, you know, and it's just a matter of framing the individual and viewing the individual.
Yeah. I don't use the word for myself. I know when I was really emotionally, I feel unstable. Depression washes over me. The story cognitively I'm telling myself and how I fit in the world is that I'm a victim. I may not be using the word, but it's making me really ill. Mm-hmm. It's making me helpless. No agency. I can't change. The world's crushed me. The world sucks. And I like always the description that, you know, I woke up and the world was blurry. I went downstairs. It's still blurry. At no point would a rational human being consider the planet went blurry. I would think something's wrong with my eyes.
Yeah.
And it's hard to do that. Like, it's not always clear to someone who has a mental health issue or a substance. The world sucks. If the world changed, I'd be happier. And to, regardless of the circumstances, it could be some trauma involved. People could have hurt you with no fault of your own. But to change that narrative, to not be a victim of that world, to give yourself clear sight, to take your ownership over your own mind and perceptions, that's powerful. So I'm glad we stopped there because I think I'm going to be a little more cautious applying the word victim to anyone.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you pointed out too, because you don't use it for yourself.
No, I don't.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Incarceration. Tell me about recovery in incarceration. Is it common?
Yeah.
While you're incarcerated?
Oh yeah. Yeah. There's, I know in my experience that in a state prison, where people are, you know, I hate to say it, but it's their home, you know, for some people that, mm-hmm. That's the end. But, there is more, people, they're making the best of it. I mean, you have to versus a county jail type situation. Everybody knows it's short term. You know, you're not going to be there for more than 2 years, anybody, whatever it is. And then most people are going to be going on or graduating to a bigger prison or a bigger prison system. So the state jail,
it's a county just socially, is it harder to make allegiances and comfort and friendships that you could pair up and
there's just
outside of gang activity?
There's just a different attitude. I think the best way I can contextualize it is the county jail felt immature and a state prison felt more mature.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
That's just how it felt.
Isn't that slang? Don't they kind of apply academics to it? Like it's high school.
You're kind of graduating, you know, college, you know, con college or the state prison. But yeah, I mean, it's more stable, you know, it's a violent environment.
Yeah.
100% because the administration makes it violent, not because the inmates make it violent.
Describe that. Like what if you're telling me that? I'm like, how's that true? They're there. Like this exists because of their crimes. How do you explain that to someone?
How do you explain what?
The violence? Power creates violence.
Yeah. I mean, I think the way you're treated from the beginning, you know, when you talk about going in, you're stripped of all your clothes, your hair may be cut off and, you know, pictures are taken of you of all your tattoos and people, you know, kind of have their way with your body. So you're already, you know, demoralized. Dehumanized. Yeah. And then, you know, you're taught what the rules are of the prison and you're taught what happens if you have an infraction or a misconduct. And the response isn't
brutality.
It's violence every time. And if you don't comply, it's violence. So everything is you comply or there's violence.
And what's the violence? Mace.
Mace, manhandling you. I mean.
Restraints.
Beating people senseless. I mean, the horror. I mean, yeah. I mean, people. Yeah. I mean, all that kind of violence. I mean, anything short of, you know, shooting or stabbing someone. Because that's just not what they have. But yeah, I mean, I witnessed, multiple people incarcerated be brutalized by staff. And from their perspective, not that it's right, but they're working within the policies that they have and they feel they're justified. So in that arena, you may have other people who are incarcerated who are cheering this on, who are grateful this is happening.
Yeah.
Because maybe it's solving something. Yeah. Or maybe it's somebody's having a crisis and it's upsetting the status quo or the homeostasis of the block. So, you know, it may be welcomed by other people and, you know, cheering it on, but certainly there's no like, oh, maybe we should be a little nicer to this person. Like, oh, maybe this is making it worse. It's like, no, if they're not going to comply, if they're going to fight back, then we just become more violent and we're always going to win because we can just lock the door.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and then looking at some of the most notable prison riots in the last 50 years, Attica, and all of these were concerns, prisoners kind of voicing their own rights, right?
Yeah.
Would you say, describe?
Yeah. So I had an experience while I was incarcerated in a state prison. There was, the prison I was in was brand new. It was just opened. And they were closing an older prison, a Western Penitentiary, which was in Pittsburgh, downtown Pittsburgh. And they were closing that and opening these two prisons that I went to. So I went to one. So the goal was to move everybody that was in Western to these new prisons while also mixing in, you know, new prisoners, because, of course, that doesn't stop the flow of people coming in. So they had people in this new prison who were moving there. Been incarcerated for decades, 5 years, you know, decade, people doing life. And, you know, you could smoke cigarettes in that prison that they came from. New prison, couldn't smoke cigarettes. They deemed it. And I remember when we got in the bus and you get to the little guard shack before they let you in, there was a huge sign, like huge, that it was a tobacco-free, smoke-free facility. And, you know, us, we were like looking forward to going upstate because we could smoke cigarettes. And that was like, oh man, I can't even smoke. So in this prison, and for me, it was just life. That was the reality. But again, for people who had been incarcerated and they're going to continue to be incarcerated, smoking was a big part of their life. Tobacco products was part of their life. And now it's just taken away arbitrarily because they're moved to a new prison. They don't have any say, nothing. So fast forward a couple months, more, you know, long-term incarcerated people move to the new prison and they're not having it. They're not into the no smoking in the prison. So there was a call to action, and everybody was instructed, all the incarcerated people by the other incarcerated people, to when it was time to go in for yard, we don't go in.
Okay.
We stay here. We stay in the yard.
Peaceful effort.
Yeah. We're just staying in the yard.
Yeah.
We're not fighting. We're just staying. We're not going back to our cells.
Yeah. Okay.
So that's what happened. So the response was every person who worked in the prison surrounded the yard because it's a riot. So eventually, you know, the response, eventually people go back to their cells.
Sure.
It's a no win situation. You're not going to win.
You don't want to get hurt.
Somebody's going to get shot. You know, eventually everybody went back to their cells, but the outcome. So the response was they fired the superintendent or the warden at the time. So they brought in a new superintendent.
Wow.
His first order of business. What do you think it was to do?
Smoking.
Allowed smoking. So smoking was brought back into the prison. But so that's the long-term consequence.
Yeah.
So the short-term outcome, those next 3 days after that happened, the entire prison was locked down. The entire prison. Nobody got to go to the yard. Nobody got to go out for phone calls.
Reset. Nothing.
They search. They bring in what they call a cert team, or this, like, these COs on, I don't know, steroids or something.
Yeah.
I don't know what they are, but they come in and they're, you know, paramilitary and dressed and yelling and barking. In every cell, they pull the two people, you know, you and your cellmate come out. You have to be stripped to your boxers. Well, first they strip search you in your cell, but then you can put your little boxers on and your little undershirt and your shower shoes. And then they handcuff you behind your back and you stand outside your cell with your head against the wall while they search your cell, and they tear everything out. They literally throw it in the hallway. It's just, you're just sitting there with your head while things are coming out. Drug dogs are going in, and then they leave. They're looking for, you know, contraband or whatever it is. But really all it is they're destroying your stuff. And they could toss it around and throw it around, and then they leave. And then you just stay locked down until it's all completed. And then,
yeah,
then they lift the lockdown and life goes back to normal.
Wow. Well, it was, you had an action committee.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
I'm surprised that I'm just surprised that you got your smoking back.
Yeah, no, I mean, yeah.
It's very surprising.
I was shocked too. Yeah, I was shocked too.
Maybe everything's my bias, my experience, my point of view. What the hell do I know? I get a real insight when I talk to you, and my sympathy is just enlarged. It's things you don't consider every day unless you had to experience it, and you have friends or loved ones that are like, do you think the sympathy of the general public is changing on some of these ideas? I mean, just firsthand from this experience of the petition, did you meet any resistance with people saying, well, yeah, enough, screw it?
There was like people who worked in law enforcement or half-assed, had a connection to law enforcement, and they would say like, oh, I can't sign that.
Sure.
Like, well, why can't you? Like, what?
Well, it's two cultures. I don't know. You know, I have family in law enforcement, and it's really hard to talk because I'm not, it's so bizarre, but they protect each other. And I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I guess if I was in some weird world where I was a police officer, I would be horrified and offended at the way correctional officers act.
It's a different standard.
Yeah. And to be grouped in as law enforcement. Yeah. I wouldn't want to be a part
of that. And COs are considered law enforcement. Yeah. Going back to recovery long term, this idea of finding a homeostasis, making the best of life at what you're calling your home. Did you see guys really experience you know, what you call a spiritual, we, in 12-step groups, they call it a spiritual awakening. Other people, a stability, the reduction of symptoms like anxiety, torment, PTSD, resentment, anger, what some could call enlightenment. This just open awareness that I'm going to be all right because you're in the moment. Like, have you seen that accomplished from short term to long, people who are doing long time?
Oh yeah. Yeah, yeah, definitely. And it occurs despite the prison and despite the staff and despite the facility and despite the policies and the rules, that aren't meant to support an individual or uplift an individual. But yeah, no, there was, in my experience, there was, you know, outside, people from Narcotics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous that brought meetings into the prison. I knew guys who were doing life who came in with a substance use disorder, continued to use while incarcerated, mm-hmm. and then got clean and sober while incarcerated. I knew guys who were doing life in prison, didn't have a substance use disorder prior to coming to prison, developed one in prison, and then got sober in prison. So, it definitely happens. And, you know, it seems to be through the same mechanisms that happen, like on the outside.
On the outside, peer to peer.
Yeah.
So, wow. What's the support look like in early sobriety then? Like, do people sponsor each other? Does the social structure still operate like AA, or is it a little more like there's, the so, spiritual pimp there, like the guy that has the most time.
Yeah. So like it was mostly like the outside visitors. Like I didn't really, and I'm sure it happens and I'm, you know, but I didn't really, like I would never, like I wouldn't have been sponsored, like had a sponsor in prison just because, the nature of it. But yeah, no, I mean, guys did, but a lot of it was making connections with the outside people. And then they would have folks that we could contact and stay in contact with
while incarcerated.
And for people who, you know, I was incarcerated near Pittsburgh from that area, you know, certainly could maintain that.
What's the contact, letters or phone calls?
Yeah. Letters and phone calls. Yeah.
So in that scenario, communicating through letters and phone calls, can someone go through the steps in the sense that after step three step four requires writing, you know, an inventory, this narrative of fear, resentment, confronting that, not just the dishonesty that you stole, this dishonesty that the world hurt me. Why am I still hurt? Why can't I resolve this? It's dishonest for me to believe this and be stuck here. And can someone experience that? Was that common that someone would do all the steps, or would it be the social kind of support of each other saying you're in recovery? Do people actually work the steps? And
yeah, I think, you know, based on the situation. So again, people who were doing, you know, significant time or life in prison, then yeah, I mean, there was definitely people doing step work and even the NA step working guides, you know, we had access to that and any kind of literature that you would want, you could certainly get your hands on. Yeah. So that was going on. But I think also, you know, people also saw it as like, you know, maybe had less time to do, that they were going to get out eventually and probably kind of putting most of the recovery stuff for like when they get home, you know, and kind of seeing what prison was just getting through.
Is any of this outside support that come on, put meetings, home groups, is this coupled with any individual therapy or group therapy that wouldn't be considered 12 step?
No, there's at least, you know, in my experience being incarcerated, every unit or block had a counselor, that was usually a CO that had got promoted to be a counselor. Maybe they got an associate's degree. I don't know.
It wasn't cognitive behavioral.
No, they were a counselor in so much as they would, like, I don't know. I honestly,
hey, you're feeling blue.
I don't even think it was that. It was like, hey, you broke the rules, you're going to get a misconduct.
Oh man.
I might be able to save you from going to the hole. Like you might get what did they call it? There was another punishment where you would have to stay in your cell for like 30 days. Like you couldn't go to yard when other people went to yard. Like you just had to watch it. Like you were grounded. It was, I forget
30
what that was
days.
Called.
Yeah. In 30 time, the perception of time, you know, and its natural course, you know, accelerates as you go farther from the start and, you know, what you assume is closer to the end. Is that interrupted by being in prison? like the experience of time passing, like in your own experience. I'm not metrically. There has to be a different experience from being in the same visuals.
Yeah,
for 10, 15 years, you can't be experiencing time.
Yeah, no, it doesn't. Even like my thinking back on my experience in cars, like it doesn't seem real. Part of it,
yeah,
like it just doesn't seem like it doesn't seem like me. It doesn't seem like a
real situation. If you dig deeper, though, do any of your not to go like because I have this problem. Are any of my memories, they don't have the feeling of being real like they did when I was youthful, like the romantic, because there's a separation I'm experiencing because I meditate longer and longer every day that you can only experience now. Like there's this stream of consciousness of what I'm calling myself. I have to put this thread of memories together that says it's me. I don't recognize it really much anymore. It's a little freaky.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, you can only experience memories based on who you are in the moment experiencing it, right? Well,
only a few at a time. How much could you think about one moment space consciously? Well, not to go into a rabbit hole, but I do enjoy talking. So I want to talk about just a little more. So NA could come in and AA, and this has been going on for decades, which is, people appreciate for sure. Is AA in itself in the prison or Narcotics Anonymous a subculture within the prison? And if so, is it a subculture that is like when, you know, say in the Jungle Book, when they all meet to, you know, a lion could sit with the sheep and have water because it's drought season. Does this rise above any gang activity, Islam?
Gotcha. So my experience, Pennsylvania prisons were very, it wasn't divisive like that.
Okay.
In my experience in exercising and playing sports and any activity I did, I never ran into a situation where there was groups or I felt out of place, like
in group, out group.
No, it honestly, it all felt, I can say for the majority of the time I was in a state prison that we were all in this together. Like that's honestly,
there's a whole structure. It's power versus us.
That's what it felt like. When I was there, I didn't feel the gang stuff. There wasn't Nazis walking the yard. If they had Nazi tattoos, they weren't allowed to weren't showcasing them because they would find out that wasn't,
that's pretty except cinematic appeal in the last 20 years of any prison movie.
Right.
The first one that kind of grabbed my whole zeitgeist of what I thought the horrors of prison was with America Me. Pepe Sarin's in it. James Olmos. It's a 1980s movie about 50s and 60s Latinos gangs in LA and the prison populations. It brings it up to the 80s. And I think it's not an homage. I think it's a true story of one of the leaders of East LA's gangs. And I was young. I could watch whatever I wanted. I'd always sneak and watch it. But it was brutal. That's what I always, it just stayed with me because my first imagery of seeing that jail wasn't, like the cat and Popeye behind the bars and stuff. It was terrifying.
With NA, so what the most, what I experienced in my attendance while incarcerated was you'd get made fun of by other people.
Like, really?
But not like
you get rest.
Yeah. You get rest. Like you're Josh.
Sober?
Yeah. What are you going to pray to God tonight? What are you going to do? You think somebody's going to help, but yeah, no, like you would just get made fun of and it wasn't like, mean or like you felt like it was just, again, like, like making fun of your favorite sports team.
Yeah.
But that's kind of what you put up with, like
someone's peanut butter jealous, dude. Hey man, chill. Yeah. I got a lot. There's a lot of time to kill here. Right. I'd go to AA if I was didn't even have a drink. I mean, don't you want to break the monotony of a schedule there? That's a long time ago. And you've been in recovery a long time and you're a licensed social worker. Do you feel it will always, is it branded in your heart to advocate for the dignity of the incarcerated?
I think that that experience, when I look back on it, certainly not knowing at the time, but when I look back on it, I think it gives me an empathy with just a marginalized group, you know, with a marginalized population. So,
and that's millions of people nationally. I mean,
2.2 million, I believe, are incarcerated.
Yeah, I mean, that's lower. That's Manhattan.
And that's not even Manhattan. That's not considering people who are on probation and parole. When you incorporate that number, yeah, it's obscene. So the people who have been incarcerated, but yeah.
And these are this is our family, friends, people we know. You just got to look a little deeper. That's 2 million people.
Yeah, the lifetime incidence for men is 1 in 9. Like 1 in 9 will be incarcerated.
So outside of your direct social work, and congrats on a new position soon. But when you every day, like how you lobby and position this, when you hear an opposition to increase sympathy and empathy for people who are incarcerated, and meeting the definition in our own country of torture, you can't equivocate this. Why is it so hard to retreat from it? Like, do we just always want to play second fiddle to the Netherlands? And I saw some of their jails. But if I explained that to like, say my grandfather's like, dude's at a, he's at a, it's a campus, it's education, it's reform. They've self-report.
It's amazing.
But it worked. Like,
so yeah, like,
why does it work there? Why could you say that can't, why? It can't work here. We have too much. Our population's too diverse. Oh, yeah, yeah. What do you say to that?
Yeah, I wouldn't know what diversity would have with treating people like like a person, for one. But yeah, I've heard that people in, because it was weird, like everybody was the same. Mm-hmm. So it was easy. Like it was a homogeneous group. So it was easier to treat that way.
And I always hear that first argument. And I'm like, do you hear what you're saying? Yeah, that's obscene.
Yeah, I don't know why diversity. I guess it would change. Potentially, if there was racist guards, yeah, they wouldn't want to treat people like humans. But what was the question?
Like, where do you begin? Where do you begin to explore and realize that, you know, this is happening to millions of people? They're our friends, they're brothers, they're fellow primates on Earth. It's fucking hard to be here. And they're getting stuffed for 22 hours at a time in a room where the light doesn't go off. We're not talking about serial killers. We're talking about all kinds of infractions. We're talking about juveniles. Where do you start to consider this? And how do you grow someone's empathy and sympathy in a discussion, just a discussion?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the first thing that I would imagine, and you know, when you say like, if you told your grandfather how this, and same if I told, you know, yeah, anybody about like how they did things in Norway, they'd be like, yeah, that's not right because that's not how you incarcerate people. So it would be a paradigm shift that would have to happen. And that would be, to me, long-term. It would take a while. And I would imagine it seems like something that as more people become aware of it and it becomes more commonplace to talk about it, President Obama, you know, whether it was a political charade or not, he went into a prison and had an interview with a handful of prisoners. I mean, he was the first sitting president to ever step foot into a prison. Yeah. And I mean, and again, you know, so I think that as we go forward, you know, just having more conversation, talking about it more. And then I think when there is the resistance to it for the people that can be reached, presenting the factual information, presenting the statistics of how many people incarcerated, who's incarcerated, why are we incarcerated? And to me, if somebody is a discerning individual and has critical thinking, they would be able to say like, oh yeah, like something's off. So why then if somebody is breaking, you know, let's say a drug law, nonviolent most of the time, then we can just treat them however we want, torture them, and they can just be subjected to it. And not to mention the loss of constitutional rights and all that stuff that's happening as well. And just to be treated not as a human, other people are watching you as you shower, like just horrible things that we wouldn't do in society. And there, it's just the norm and nobody questions it. And yeah, so again, I think it's a paradigm shift and
it's out of sight,
presenting too. Information is out of sight, out of mind. And then, you know, I don't know what the revenge or the retribution is thing where it's just like, oh, like
Why for the people who would want to advocate for themselves, mostly the urgency to advocate would be that you're incarcerated. And who are the people on the outside that are the voice? But there's a lot of good organizations I'm going to put links to if people want to explore what this could mean to them and what they're aware of and what they're not is vera.org to confront the idea of mass incarceration of a large population of U.S. citizens. And www.afsc.org is a lobby and advocates for the end of solitary confinement. John, there's so much to talk about, and I wanted to try to talk, you know, for an hour just on solitary confinement because it's intense. I mean, anyone could do a thought exercise of what it's like to be alone for 10 minutes. All movement. Some yogi masters always say you move because of pain. You always move, but try to sit still for as long as you can. You'll move because of pain. This is the agency of life. You're just moving around because you're uncomfortable. Put that person who's suffering from any number of mental health disorders. Man, it's just nightmarish to think about. It really freaks me out.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just,
well, you got to come back because you're always schooling me on things I haven't had time to really consider. And I'm around a lot of people that just are getting out of jail. And, I don't see them being any different than me at all. I would advocate for the dignity of anybody not to be isolated in a room alone without human contact when maybe the poorest decisions they made in their life are a result of not having connection. Sounds like a total nightmare we're stuck in. Well, John, please come back. Anything? You're right up the street.
Right up the street, man.
Yeah. Welcome to the show. Sometimes it's my attic. Sometimes it's all better. I'll put those websites out there. I'd like to thank you for listening to another episode of All Better. You can find us on allbetter.fm. Or listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and Alexa. Special thanks to our producer, John Edwards, and engineering company 570 Drone. Please like or subscribe to us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. And if you're not on social media, you're awesome. Looking forward to seeing you again. And remember, just because you're sober doesn't mean you're right. Hi, this is Joe Van Wee, your host of All Better. I had a few announcements. If you're interested in subscriber content, which we're about to launch, this would be STEP workshops, cognitive behavioral therapy tools, and mindfulness practices that are approachable and can be very useful in reducing anxiety, rumination, and depression. Please send us a message on Facebook, Instagram, or LinkedIn. And if you like the episodes that you've been hearing very much, please stop by Apple Podcasts. Give us a 5-star rating and a small review. This helps us stay relevant in the field of content and helping people and their families with substance use disorder. Thank you.